The headlines, Ayatollah Khamenei says Iran is a victim of maritime piracy, and by seizing the Greek tankers, it has indeed taken back what it rightfully owned. Iran says a visit by the IAEA chief to Israel just ahead of a meeting of the Board of Governors could erode the agency's credibility. And 100 days into the war in Ukraine, both Moscow and Kiev renew their pledges to fight on for victory. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisoum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the West is seeking to turn Iranian people against their government and establishment, but to no avail. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei added the enemy is making miscalculations by erroneously believing that it can stir up public dissent in the country. He noted Iranians' interests in the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic establishment is growing day by day. The leader said the people's enthusiasm in the Islamic Republic was generated by the wise leadership of the late leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. Ayatollah Khamenei reiterated that the late Imam's ideals have inspired not only Iranians but Muslims around the world. The leader also said Iran is a victim of maritime piracy, and by seizing the Greek oil tankers, it has indeed taken back what it rightfully owned. Earlier, we were joined by political analyst Said Mohsen Abbas with his take on Imam Khomeini's thoughts and everlasting legacy.
I would say that that's his most powerful and major contribution, is to bring about a revolution and the establishment of a nation which, after many, many centuries, actually is directed at least towards this notion of creating a divine rule on earth and to establish human beings in their true balanced nature within a social context and a political context, which actually is geared towards their natural inclination and towards the betterment of all humanity. Now, that's something very, very unique, I think, which people mustn't overlook. People were often confused. Those who studied Imam Khomeini in his early years, they couldn't understand, because of the unique nature of who he was and what he represented, they could not understand whether he was a politician, or whether he was a jurisprudent, or he was a mystic. These were just three elements that came to the fore about his amazing personal character, but also as a father and as a husband. His whole mannerism was ultimately rooted and based in Ahlul Bayt. It was based in the central teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. He was almost like an individual who'd been developed in the 7th century, but had all the notions and ideas of how to deal with a contemporary problem in the world, and that problem was secular neoliberalism, essentially imperialism and tyranny.
Professor Hakima Biria earlier joined us with her insight on how Iran's Islamic Revolution unfolded through the committed and pious oversight of the late Ayatollah Khomeini.
What we had before the Islamic Revolution's victory was a system that was based on a bipolar world, a system of dominance that was based on, on the one hand we had the Soviet Union, and the other hand we had the United States, each of which were trying to have places of influence. And Iran was, of course, under the influence of the United States, and was so it had no agency of its own with regard to its internal affairs and with regard to its foreign policy. So in this sense, Imam Khomeini actually later on, after the revolution, he addresses the Muslims of the world and says that you are under a situation that you are approaching your death. It is his word for it is gradual death. You're experiencing gradual death. So in the words of Imam Khomeini, the region, the West Asian region, and of course the whole world is under this kind of situation that people have no say in what is happening around them.
Tehran reacts after the controversial visit by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency to Israel, days after criticism of Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Iran's foreign ministry warns of further erosion of the agency's credibility, while its Director General kept silent on Israel's secret nuclear arsenal. Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says, "This questions the IAEA's impartiality. Iran is one of the signatories of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Israel, however, has never signed up to the treaty that aims to ensure civilian use of the nuclear technology. The regime backs the draft resolution prepared by the U.S. and its allies to rebuke Iran by the IAEA Board of Governors. Tehran has warned against any unconstructive action at the upcoming meeting of the body, saying it will respond immediately and proportionately." This is the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. The Vienna-based agency is supposed to monitor compliance with the 1968 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The NPT has been described as the centerpiece of global efforts to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons, promote cooperation in the peaceful uses of nuclear energy, and to achieve the goal of nuclear disarmament. The IAEA is supposed to have technical and professional cooperation with NPT signatories away from politics. The Atomic Agency has had a high-profile role regarding Iran's nuclear energy program. In 2015, when Iran and the P5+1 struck a deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the IAEA was tasked with monitoring Iran's compliance with the terms of the agreement. In many of its reports over the past years, the agency has said that it has found no evidence of any diversion in Iran's nuclear program. As the fate of the faltering 2015 deal remains increasingly unclear, the technical role and supposed independence of the atomic watchdog are being tested. In a recent report, the IAEA said Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium had grown to more than 18 times the limit allowed in the 2015 agreement. The agency also said Iran has failed to answer its remaining questions. Tehran described the IAEA's latest statements as one-sided, saying that it fails to reflect Iran's extensive cooperation with the agency.
The International Atomic Energy Agency seems to be succumbing to the same sort of takeover that the United States and the Anglo-Zionist Empire has been doing to so many other international organizations, such as, for example, in athletics, for example, in economics with the World Economic Forum, for example. All these organizations, they seem to want to control them.
Meanwhile, reports say Western countries lobbied by Israel are planning to push the International Atomic Energy Agency to criticize Iran at its upcoming meeting of the Board of Governors. Iran has repeatedly warned that the IAEA's works must remain technical and away from politics. This week, Foreign Minister Hossein Ahmed Abdollahian warned against any political interference in the technical affairs of the agency. He stressed the need for avoiding political approaches in the forthcoming Board of Governors meeting. This as Israel has stepped up its campaign to get the West on board to pile pressure on Iran. Let's watch. Back in March, Rafael Grossi, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, visited Iran. The IAEA and Iran announced at the end of the visit that they had agreed on an approach for resolving remaining bilateral issues. The visit came as representatives from Iran and the P4+1 were trying to find a way to move forward in their negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 deal. The talks are currently stalled, with Iran saying the United States is failing to make necessary political decisions. At this point, any stance by the Atomic Agency could have an important effect on the stalled talks. This week, Iran's top diplomat said Tehran and the agency's agreement in March was mutually satisfactory. He warned that political interference in the technical affairs of the agency is totally unconstructive. Amir Abdollahian's comments came ahead of a meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors scheduled for June the 6th. Days left to the meeting, the IAEA chief has arrived in Israel after Tel Aviv released documents alleging Iran spied on the IAEA. Iran says Israel, which has refused to join the NPT and is believed to possess hundreds of nuclear warheads, hates the JCPOA and wants to derail the effort to revive it.
The problem with much of what the International Atomic Energy Agency has been doing is that it is trying to find excuses to really, I suppose, make out that the Iranian nuclear program is a military program. And one of the problems with the IAEA is they're not looking anywhere near as closely at the Israelis, who do have nuclear weapons. They tried to keep it secret, but Mordecai Vanunu blew the whistle in the Sunday Times here in Britain back in the 1980s and did a massive jail term for his, when he was kidnapped, actually, for his trouble. That they do have many nuclear weapons, probably something like 200, they say.
Reports say the United States and its Western allies, pushed by Israel, plan to pile pressure on Iran at the upcoming IAEA meeting. Tehran has warned that it would respond firmly and appropriately to any such move because Tehran has been cooperating based on the agreement reached in March. The fate of months of negotiations between Iran and the P4+1 seems to be at stake as a meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors draws close. Who would benefit from a possible collapse of the talks? Thousands of Yemenis take to the streets of the capital Sana'a and other cities, including Sada and Hajjah, in the public display of the nation's resolve against the Saudi-led war on the country. Demonstrators with a Yemen's flag chanted slogans against the aggressors and their key ally, the United States. The Yemenis were on the streets to make it clear to the enemies that their country will remain independent and free. The demonstrations were held in honor of the late founder of Ansarullah movement, Hossein al-Houthi. The demonstrators also slammed dishonest calls for peace made by certain Arab governments that have normalized relations with the Israeli regime. The Yemenis reiterated their support for the Palestinian cause. Meanwhile, the UN envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, says parties of the war in Yemen have agreed to extend the truce for another 2 months. Analysts say the agreement could pave the way for ending the conflict. Abdul Latifa Washali reports.
Following intense UN-supervised meetings between the warring sides in Yemen, the UN envoy for Yemen announced that the parties have agreed to renew the current truce in Yemen for 2 more months. The truce is extended under the same terms as the original agreement, which first came into effect on the 2nd of April.
When the United Nations agreed to our conditions, which included releasing the salaries of government employees, we saw that it was our duty to respond to the renewal of the truce, although we were aware that the enemy would not respect the truce as it did previously. But we adhere to peaceful solutions and we will make concessions in order to end the war.
Observers say renewing the truce is a win for the Yemenis, who stood alone during 7 years of war without any support from the international community or the United Nations.
The United Nations was absent throughout the years of war, and the armistice is not an achievement for the international body, but rather a success for Sana'a, which remained alone in facing war and siege without any support from the international community or any allies.
Grundberg said he will continue engaging with the parties to implement and consolidate all elements of the truce.
People, he hoped that renewing the UN brokered truce will build for a comprehensive political solution to end the war that devastated their lives and country. They say the international community should now step in properly to support the political process in Yemen. Reporting for Press TV, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
100 days into the war in Ukraine, Russia says it will continue its military operation until all of its goals are achieved. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says one of Moscow's main goals is to protect people of the self-proclaimed republics of Donetsk and Luhansk. With the war raging in eastern Ukraine, Peskov says Russia has achieved certain results. He says these include what he called liberation of some areas from Ukrainian military control. However, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky pushed back, pledging victory against Russian forces. Moscow launched a military operation in Ukraine on February 24th. It came after the United States and its allies ignored Moscow's complaints about NATO's expansion near Russia's borders. Meanwhile, anti-war demonstrations have been held in Italy, with protesters calling on the government to stop sending weapons to Ukraine and leave NATO. The initiatives took place while the Italian authorities were celebrating the 76th anniversary of the Republic.
It's the day Italy celebrates becoming a republic. On this day, in a referendum held in 1946, Italians opted to abolish the country's short-lived monarchy and adopt a republican form of government. Every year, the celebrations feature large military and official parades along the ancient Roman Forum in the presence of the highest officers of the state. Never before have controversies over the military parade been this contentious, with anti-war demonstrations held in a number of Italian cities, including Bologna, Padua and Bari.
We are here to protest against the government's decision to send weapons to Ukraine and to stage a military parade on our Republic Day, while there is a war raging on in Europe.
One of the anti-war protests was held in central Rome, 500 meters away from the Republic Day celebrations. The initiative had been called by the base union USB and political party Power to the People.
Enough with military escalation in Ukraine, which is mainly in the interest of the US. Italy and the EU are not protecting people's interests. Most people don't want this war. We have to leave NATO, ASAP, and the Draghi government must go now.
Since the start of the Ukraine conflict, opinion polls have steadily shown over half of the Italians oppose sending weapons to Kyiv and believe sanctions against Russia are useless. Protesters are angered not only over the Mario Draghi government's military spending on Ukraine, which they say would be better spent on raising workers' wages. They are also opposing the government's decision to raise military expenditure from 1.4 to 2% of the country's GDP.
This is a criminal choice. It's unbelievable. After years of slashing the welfare state, shame on the government.
I don't have anything against arms spending if weapons are used for defense purposes, not to fight proxy wars or to pillage other countries.
According to studies carried out by a number of Italy-based think tanks, Italians have never been eager to increase defense expenditures. Based on data from the 1950s to date, on average, less than 20% of respondents believe that military spending is too low or should be increased. Max Civili, Rome.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
Imagine that every state were free to choose whether to allow black people and white people to marry. Some states would permit such marriages, others probably wouldn't. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece is titled, America is Not Ready for the End of Roe v. Wade. Imagine that every state were free to choose whether to allow black people and white people to marry. Some states would permit such marriages, others probably wouldn't. The laws would be a mishmash, and interracial couples would suffer, legally consigned to second-class status depending on where they lived. It seems an unthinkable scenario in 2022. That's because in 1967, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled that barring interracial marriage, as 16 states still did, violates the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal protection. Under our Constitution, the freedom to marry or not marry a person of another race resides with the individual and cannot be infringed by the state, the court stated in Loving v. Virginia. More than half a century on, Loving is considered one of the court's greatest rulings, and yet it was not universally admired at the time. Southern U.S. states complied only grudgingly. Alabama didn't repeal its ban on interracial marriage until 2000. That's the point of having a federal constitution that is supreme. The guarantees and rights in that document apply to all Americans equally, wherever they live. The court system, and the Supreme Court in particular, exist to protect those rights when state and local authorities refuse to. Many who oppose Roe v. Wade today, and even some who support it, argue that the 1973 ruling short-circuited a running debate over abortion. A debate that should have been allowed to play out in the states, many of which had long banned abortion. This is one of the main justifications in the leaked draft opinion in which a majority of U.S. Supreme Court justices appear ready to overturn Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, the 1992 decision that preserved Roe v. Wade's central holding with certain restrictions. The problem with this reasoning is that, as in the Loving case, leaving the matter to individual states and the political process means that millions of Americans will be denied their fundamental rights. In this case, the right of women to decide what happens inside their own bodies. The draft opinion relies heavily on the lack of a mention of abortion in the Constitution, and therefore argues that the document cannot be the basis for the right to terminate a pregnancy. The Constitution also says nothing about interracial marriage, but that didn't prevent the justices from finding in the 14th Amendment the guarantee that no couple may be treated differently because of the color of their skin. In short, constitutional rights are meaningless unless they apply across the entire country. That is why the U.S. Supreme Court decided Loving v. Virginia and Roe v. Wade as it did. These rights are inherent in the Constitution, even if they are not explicit in it. The principle is clear. Women and men should have equal control over their own bodies, as many Americans believed in 1973, and a majority of Americans believe today. And yet, the right to choose whether to terminate a pregnancy is on the verge of being eliminated, because five members of the current U.S. Supreme Court don't like it. Congress has failed repeatedly to codify the protections of Roe v. Wade and Casey in federal law despite various efforts, not only from Democrats but also from two Senate Republicans, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Top Democrats are now left planning a vote on the abortion rights bill that they know has zero chance of passing. This is an empty gesture coming after years of the Democratic Party failing to provide meaningful leadership on reproductive freedom, despite the clear warning signs that Roe v. Wade was endangered. President Biden, as leader of the Democratic Party, has an obligation to take the threat to Americans' constitutional rights seriously by doing all he can to protect access to abortion where it still exists. The White House can encourage regulators to make it easier for women to get medication, abortions, and over-the-counter birth control, to challenge state laws that limit access to medication, abortions, and to lease federal property to abortion providers. This would at least show a commitment to the issue, even if legislative options are limited. Overall, the outlook for reproductive freedom in America is bleak. In 13 states, trigger laws will automatically or very quickly ban abortions after Roe v. Wade is overturned, as seems highly likely. In about a dozen other states, lawmakers are gearing up to severely restrict access to abortions, if not effectively prohibit them, as Texas has already done without interference by the U.S. Supreme Court. The upshot? Within a few months, abortion could be illegal in more than half of the states. The anti-abortion movement isn't stopping there. Efforts are already underway to impose a nationwide ban on abortion as soon as Republicans regain the White House and the Congress, which could happen as soon as 2025. For the foreseeable future, the real battle for reproductive freedom will be fought in the states by regular Americans and their state and local representatives who are trying to protect this fundamental right while they still can. That means, first and foremost, securing more access. California lawmakers are moving quickly to pass a package of bills that would make their state, the most populous in the country, also one of the most accessible for women seeking to exercise their reproductive freedom. Those most in need of abortions are often the least able to afford them. States that want to protect reproductive freedom are helping to pay for the procedure and for the travel required to obtain it, costs that can easily run into thousands of dollars and are prohibitive for many women. Data from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention show the percentage of abortion services in Illinois and New York provided to non-residents has already risen sharply over the past decade, a trend driven by increased restrictions on abortions elsewhere in America. New York lawmakers are considering a bill that would direct funds to abortion providers, allowing them to increase staffing and security to meet already rising demand. In March, Oregon lawmakers approved a $15 million fund for these purposes, which should help provide access to abortion not only for residents of the state, but also for those in neighboring states of Idaho, which has already passed a bill that would prohibit abortions after about 6 weeks. All laws are subject to being overturned when the political winds shift, of course. That's why abortion rights groups in some states are focused on their own constitutions. In New York, supporters of abortion rights, including Governor Kathy Hochul, are pushing for a constitutional amendment that would go before New York voters in 2024 to protect reproductive rights in case the state legislature falls into Republican hands. In Michigan, Governor Gretchen Whitmer last month asked her state Supreme Court to rule that the Michigan Constitution affirmatively protects the right to an abortion. Finally, pro-choice states are realizing that they have to play some strategic defense when it comes to protecting abortion providers, and possibly women who get abortions themselves, from states that reach outside their borders to force their anti-abortion laws on everyone else. Missouri lawmakers, for example, are considering a bill that would allow its residents to sue anyone in any state who helps a Missouri resident get an abortion. In anticipation of laws like these, a bill in New York would bar law enforcement authorities from assisting in the out-of-state investigation of abortion providers or women who seek abortions in New York. The Connecticut General Assembly has gone even further, passing a law to allow providers in the state to countersue anyone who sues them for damages for providing abortion care. Meanwhile, in Louisiana, a state that still imposes the death penalty, lawmakers recently passed out of committee a bill that would define fertilized egg as a full person, meaning that anyone who performs an abortion and any woman who obtains one could be charged with murder. What all this shows is that the right to an abortion cannot be left at the mercy of individual states, something that few people on either side of this issue genuinely seem to want. This is why a national standard is necessary. That national standard, at least for a few more weeks, is Roe v. Wade, as modified by Planned Parenthood v. Casey. These two rulings are not perfect, but for all their flaws, they have managed to strike a delicate balance that reflects the public's complex position on a morally fraught issue. The majority of the American people do not want these cases overturned, and an overwhelming majority say that abortion should not be banned outright. If you thought that Roe v. Wade itself led to discord and division, then just wait until it's gone.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to Iran's Vienna talks, lots of advancements were made to the point that some thought that a deal was imminent. Now the latest news is that the United States, France, Britain, and Germany are pushing for the IAEA to rebuke Iran for failing to answer long-standing questions. Iran has said that it will respond in a strong and appropriate manner to any unconstructive action at the upcoming IAEA Board of Governors meeting. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why things are looking so different now and the chances that a draft resolution will be submitted at the next Board of Governors meeting. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition joins us from San Francisco. Also joining us is Robert Fantina. He's an author, journalist, and activist who joins us from Kitchener. All right, welcome to you both. Richard Becker, I'll start with you. There was a time not too long ago that we were looking at potential breakthrough because of the way that things were being presented. Things like 90% of the way is achieved. We just have a few remaining outstanding issues. And now we're looking at how the U.S., France, Britain, Germany are pushing for the IAEA to rebuke in a strong and appropriate manner. Iran saying that it's going to respond. And this is on the governor's, the Board of Governors meeting for a resolution to perhaps be leveled against Iran. Why do you think things have changed so dramatically?
I think that we have to look at who the personnel are who are now running U.S. foreign policy. And that would include, in addition to the president, most importantly, his national security advisor, Sullivan, the person who's in charge of the Indo-Pac region, that's Kurt Campbell, the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, and a number of others who really come from the Hillary Clinton era State Department, who rose to prominence in that period, and who are really neocons, very hawkish neocons. And they have become much more hawkish since the war in Ukraine began. And their intervention, the U.S. intervention that they are directing in the war, which is prolonging the war, making the war ever more deadly and ever more dangerous of escalation, I think we have to see that in connection to other aspects of U.S. foreign policy, key aspects of U.S. foreign policy. So we have this really heightened hostility and belligerence toward Iran, toward China, of course, toward Russia. But I think that these are all tied together, and that the what the objective is of this foreign policy group is to reestablish the and carry out, they hope, the objective of the U.S. being the dominant power, the sole dominant power in the world. And this means an even more hostile and belligerent attitude toward what are perceived of as their enemies, or they perceive as their enemies. They're not the enemies of the people of the United States, I want to say that, but they perceive them to be anyone who stands in the way of that objective of U.S. global domination.
Yeah, but there's certain aspects of this Board of Governors meeting that's upcoming, Robert Fantina, that we need to talk about that is turning the table against Iran. For example, when it comes to the issue of stockpile, the quarterly IAEA report is saying that Iran has exceeded its, limit by more than, it says, 18 times. But, you know, things have to be put into perspective. Iran's permanent representative to the international organization, IAEA, has said that that's one-sided and that it fails to reflect Iran's extensive cooperation when it comes to the IAEA. Why is the IAEA being swayed in this direction? We know in the way that IAEA presents its facts, or not even present it, depending on how it sees it, obviously it could influence countries like the U.S., the ones that are party to the Vienna talks.
Yes, and it works the other way around also. The United States influences that the agency itself, the atomic agency. And we have to also look at the Israeli connection. Israel is accusing Iran of deception, of lying, going back and looking at documents that date back to 2002.
Okay, looks like
all kinds of different things.
Go ahead. No. For a second, you were frozen. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yes, but there are many things to look at here. It wasn't Iran that violated JCPOA. So if Iran is enriching its uranium to a higher level, it's within its rights to do so. The JCPOA ceased to exist when the U.S. Withdrew from it. Now, the United States, France, Germany are pressuring the Atomic Agency to criticize, to find something, to find fault with in Iran so that the JCPOA can be seen or viewed by the United States as having failed, not due to U.S. actions, but due to Iranian actions, which is a complete lie. But this is what we're seeing now today. The United States is trying to maneuver the Atomic Energy Agency to find some criticism of Iran so that the United States can act in some way, possibly get off the table, because The United States doesn't believe in diplomacy. It only believes in force. And this is, as your other commentator mentioned, this is all part of the United States trying to reinforce its worldwide domination. This is being opposed by many nations, Iran being just one of them. But the United States will fight hard to re-achieve that.
So here we have a second report also, Richard Becker, and we need to break this down a little bit, of which you're having the IAEA, for example, highlight the fact that Iran is not giving a sufficient explanation regarding traces of uranium. You have, the representative to the IAEA who has said that Iran's civilian nuclear program is carried out under the auspices of not only the IAEA in terms of the monitoring, but also Iran is carrying out its work within the framework of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or the NPT. And that within that framework, its legal obligations are being carried out. So again, it puts into question the motive that the IAEA has, or the IAEA chief, I should say, in the way that it's presenting its report. Again, what is influencing the IAEA to steer in that direction?
Well, it's all a question of power, and I think that that's true. But there's been a shift. We should see the shift that's taken place where Germany, France, Britain, but particularly Germany and France, I think, have much more aligned themselves with the U.S. in global foreign policy through NATO since the beginning of the Ukraine war. There were a lot of differences leading up to that. But it's essentially the domination of the United States. And, you know, we have these stories that come out, like your other guest referred to, the documents that really turned out to be documents from 2004, 2006, that they're trying to portray as the Israeli intelligence, Mossad, is trying to portray as that's what's going on now. Those documents prove what they're asserting is going on now. We have no way to really know about any of this, and so many times in the past, these assertions, these allegations, turn out to have been completely fabricated. I mean, this has been going on for a long, long time. It's not anything new, but I think that we can see that if we look objectively at the record, that Iran met all the conditions of the JCPOA, and the IAEA. At that time, was reporting on a regular basis that Iran was meeting all the requirements, but the U.S. then broke the treaty, as the U.S. government has broken so many other treaties, unilaterally broke that treaty, and then the U.S. allies, the European powers that were part of the JCPOA, said to Iran, "Don't break the agreement. Stay with the agreement. Keep meeting your requirements, and we'll find some way to get around the sanctions." And then that never happened. That never took place. So the responsibility, the blame for this crisis rests firmly with Washington. And the answer to try to move forward also lies there. If the U.S. wants to move this process forward, it'll move forward. If they don't want to move it forward, it appears that they're able to put this pressure on the IAEA, along with its allies, to come up with ways to block the reinstatement of the JCPOA.
It needs to be mentioned, Robert Fintina, the fact that the agency, based on what Iran has said, would not have any access to that memory information of its cameras. And other information in that regard, Iran made it clear. Iran said that until an agreement is reached for the revival of the JCPOA, that information is not going to be released. Let's move on to some of the fabrications leveled by Israel, in this case in point, just recently by the Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, and break that down a little bit here. Just recently, a couple of days back, I guess, documents Naftali Bennett came on and said were taken from Iran, showing Iranian intelligence, according to what he was saying, spied on the UN's Atomic Energy Agency in order to better cover up what he said was Iran's rogue nuclear activities. And he said, so how do we know this? Iran stole this classified documents and used that information to systematically, I'm using his words, to evade nuclear probes. This is what he wrote on Twitter. First of all, what do you think when he comes out and says that?
Well, there are many things there. One is he's criticizing Iran's nuclear program when Bennett and previous Israeli governments have denied their own nuclear program and haven't offered any kind of transparency about it whatsoever. And that is an apartheid regime that is involved in some of the most heinous war crimes and crimes against humanity on a daily basis. So Bennett is in no position to be criticizing Iran or anyone else. Also, we have to look at how Mossad got these documents, these alleged documents. It stole them from the IAEA. And as both Mr. Becker and I have mentioned, these documents go back as much as 18 years. They are not current. They don't cover the time immediately preceding, during, or after the JCPOA. So they're, even if they're legitimate, and it's highly questionable whether or not they are irrelevant to today's, what's happening today. However, Bennett and the all Israeli government and the U.S. government will seize upon them, look for some way of criticizing Iran and giving the United States a means that it will perceive as legitimate, but it certainly isn't, to not reinstate the JCPOA. The U.S. violated the JCPOA, broke the treaty. It is up to the U.S. to unilaterally re-enter it. The U.S. has refused to do that. And these documents that Bennett is saying are so important to the future of any agreement with Iran are simply not valid in this situation.
Okay, this is the part, Richard Becker, that needs to be pointed out to. I mean, if anybody's following the story and just reads, and I'm going to refer to what I'm about to say, Richard Becker, to an Israeli publication that has cited this. It says, the files were part of a cache allegedly stolen. I'm sorry, it was a slip. Allegedly taken by Israeli agents, because the publication is saying that, from an Iranian warehouse in the year 2018. Okay? So my question is, if these were taken in the year 2018, why does Naftali Bennett have to wait until now, this moment, to come out and say what it's saying? I mean, it doesn't take really a rocket scientist to figure this out in terms of looking through the statements and seeing where the you know, what word can be used, where the deception is or where the falsification is. What do you think about that, about the date of when this was taken and the revelation, so to speak, by Naftali Bennett?
Well, of course, they're using the stolen information, with whatever it may be, whatever it actually may be, but they've been waiting for some moment to bring it out and or to allege that this is what it says. And I want to keep emphasizing that we really can have no confidence in what this material is. But it's clearly being done from a tactical point of view in the way of Israel trying to block a return to the JCPOA. And Israel has played this role, but it cannot play this role effectively without being granted the right to do so by Washington. And this is one of the... So I think that we can see that there's some shift that's taken place in Washington, where it did look, as you said at the top of the show, like it was moving toward an agreement and just, you know, a few details to work out, until now when it looks like the direction is the opposite, that it's moving further and further away from a new agreement. That's not to say that it can't happen. Other developments in the world can weigh in on this. But right now, it looks like, you know, the shift is on, and the shift would not be on unless in Washington, in the administration, there was a desire to prevent the agreement from being reinstated or a similar agreement being reached.
Well, Robert Fantina, it's not the first time that we heard about Israel lying or fabricating or using false information, because I have to say it in that manner and use those words, because Bennett comes out and says, quote, Iran lied to the world. Iran is lying to the world again right now, and the world must make sure that Iran doesn't get away scot-free. I'm sure you can cite, or almost anyone can cite, different ways that Israel has lied about Iran. Nobody, I'm sure, can forget the way that the former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came on the stand at the UN and brought up that cardboard picture with the magic marker drawing. Nobody can forget that. That Iran is just a short time away from getting the or obtaining a nuclear bomb. There are other incidents. Netanyahu with a full Hollywood-style display about the Ahmad Project, Ahmad as he called it, or we can talk about how it also made allegations against Iran. Actually, going back to the year 1996, Netanyahu has every opportunity practically he had leveling these types of accusations. Why does Israeli statements even have an audience and for an agency like an IAEA to take it into account?
It's only because the United States is ordering the IAEA to do so. You mentioned Netanyahu and his picture of the bomb. I documented a couple of years ago how many times Netanyahu or other Israeli leaders said that the government of Iran was a couple of months away from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Repeatedly over the years, they have lied about this. It's also Israel that is assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists and denying culpability. It's Israel that is repeatedly committing crimes against humanity, saying it's doing it in the name of its national security. The credibility of the Israeli government is non-existent. However, the United States is powerful enough still to coerce organizations such as the United Nations and its various departments to appear to give credibility to what Israel says. It's simply coming from the United States, and any other government leaders must look at this and think, how are they going to pretend that these statements are reasonable, but they must do so or experience the wrath of the United States.
One of the things that's confusing, Richard Becker, about the Israeli stance of going all out, trying to prevent from any type of agreement on this issue to come into fruition, is the fact that they are under the impression that Iran has its hands cut off when it comes to revenues. And Iran has said that, you know, these sanctions, we're still making our money when it comes to oil sales. Iran has said that. They have found Iran has been under sanctions for decades. They know their way around sanctions. And in a more general sense, that's a message to the U.S., where under this so-called maximum pressure policy, it has failed. The U.S. has even said that. Why does Israel think that it has to go all out, thinking it's going to cut off the money supply of Iran by going after this Vienna talks and its failure, that it's so adamant about doing it and going after it?
Well, I think it's clear that Israel has been hoping that there would be a war against Iran, a war that would severely weaken Iran. I mean, I don't think that's about to happen, but I think that's what they want. And I think it's been clear that that's what they wanted. And they wanted a bigger war, you know, not just Israel against Iran, but, you know, for the U.S. to come into the war. And Israel's aim is to be the dominant regional power. Of course, they have to do that in conjunction with the U.S. And it's not, Turkey is also a regional power. But they see, Israel sees Iran as its number one contender or enemy in terms of who's the dominant power in the region. And the U.S. is very much involved in this too. There's the resistance bloc that exists in the region, which is opposed to imperialist domination and to Israel. And the U.S. and Israel and some of the other U.S. allies consistently are seeking to weaken that resistance bloc in order to dominate the region as a whole, the U.S. and Israel. So I think that that's the reality. And the other thing about this is that it's just so fundamentally dishonest is that the NPT proliferation treaty says that the nuclear power, in addition to it's always invoked to talk about countries that might be developing nuclear weapons that aren't supposed to under that. But the other part of it is that the nuclear weapons states are supposed to be disarming. And the United States is in the midst of a multi-trillion dollar, 10-year project to upgrade, quote unquote, improve its nuclear weapons. And you know, so they are in complete defiance every day of the NPT.
And that includes Israel. My final question, Robert Fatina, is that Iran has come out and said the Israeli regime is the world's number one JCPOA hater, happens to be the NPT denier. This is the foreign ministry that came out, as a spokesperson, that is, who said this. And the only nuke possessor of the MENA region. We know this. The world knows this. Time for the E3 U.S. to stop pretending to be asleep. And he rounds off his statements by saying they can pursue diplomacy or pursue the opposite. We're ready for both. What do you think the opposite is, based on how he sees it?
Well, the opposite, of course, is war at its extreme. And the United States or Israel would be extremely foolish to go to war with Iran. Iran is a powerful country. It has powerful allies. This would not be an easy war. It would not be a quick war. It would be extremely deadly and devastating for much of the world. The JCPOA benefited Iran very much. But as was mentioned earlier, Iran has lived with sanctions and will continue to do so. But the government of Israel does hate the JCPOA. Benjamin Netanyahu, as prime minister, spoke to the U.S. Congress.
Very well. Thank you. We're fresh out of time. I'm sorry about that.
Thank you.
Robert Fantina. Right. I apologize. Robert Fantina there, author, journalist, and activist from Kitchener. Richard Becker, thank you so much from the Answer Coalition, who spoke to us from San Francisco. And with that, we come to the end of this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitafway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, Allah, Allah.
Today's tip: what should one do in order to gain a real pleasure in their worship, their ubudiyah, and their servitude to Allah?
Allah, Allah, Allahu Rabbi, la sharika lahu.
So, dear listeners, when we are talking about the secrets of what we should do in order to increase our pleasure and our satisfaction and our contentment in our ubudiyah, there is a certain subject which comes up, and that is to have a cheerfulness of the heart when it comes to our worship and our obedience to Allah. Now, here, a cheerful heart, of course, it means that when we go to do our prayers, or when we go to do our supplications, our du'as, or the different litanies and the different dhikr, remembrance of Allah, or the tasbih, the glorification of Allah.